Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to the program, and good President's Day to you. Glad to have you listening here on the 17th of February. I'm Neil Stavem, Ryan Thomas there, and looking forward to a great discussion today. Today, of course, just in case you're wondering, no mail today, and the postal people probably would have had a little challenge anyway with just looking in the radar of Twin Cities kind of ending with the snow, but Wisconsin and Iowa getting a bunch of it, so our Faith 1090 and Faith 1190 folks are going to be kind of in the middle of it. Fargo and Sioux Falls had it yesterday.
This precipitation brought to you by the presidents of the United States.
Yeah. Maybe so. So you can enjoy the day off. You know, we're going to talk today actually about the presidents and leadership and manly men. It's going to be a great discussion today. In fact, maybe on kind of a related note, I noticed over the weekend this kind of sad news story that the inventor of the TV remote control died. They found him in the living room, stuffed under some couch cushions. Sorry.
Oh, President's Day.
You can blame Tim Hawkins for that, because that was his joke, actually. But it does sort of relate to, and I knew I wanted to share that with you because you were kind of having a tough day anyway.
Thank you so much. That makes me feel...
put you right over the edge. It sort of relates today because we are going to talk about, manly men, and that, you know, they're not just guys sitting on the couch watching TV. And at least I'm pretty sure that's not what Stephen Mansfield had in mind when he wrote his latest book, The Book of Manly Men. And we want to introduce Stephen Mansfield to us. He's a New York Times bestselling author, popular speaker, coaches leaders worldwide, and he speaks and writes about leadership, the lessons of history, and the currents of contemporary culture. A number of bestselling books, The Faith of George W. Bush, The Faith of Barack Obama. Written celebrated biographies of Booker T. Washington, George Whitefield, Winston Churchill, Abraham Lincoln, and others. And we wanted to talk to him today because it's President's Day, and just to get some perspective on that. And Stephen, apologize for the introduction here. Ryan is kind of laughing uncontrollably, but he is a manly man, though. I just want you to know that.
Glad to hear it.
You've let's just jump right in, and maybe you can kind of tell your story a little bit as we go along. But I mean, you've written a number of books on the faith of several presidents, Abraham Lincoln, George Bush, President Obama, and reading over the weekend your book of Manly Men, and you talk a lot about characteristics of other leaders too, like Theodore Roosevelt and Harry Truman and others. So I'm interested: are there some similarities that you've seen in these leaders, maybe in terms of their faith and how that informed their daily lives?
Yeah, I have a fundamental belief that comes out of my study of history, and particularly presidents, leaders, and it's that whatever a man or a woman believes religiously, or what approaches religiously in their lives, is going to shape what they do, whether they intend for it to or not. And particularly if their religion is dear to them, if it's something that they acknowledge and make central, it will shape what they do. So you really can't understand their leadership. You can't anticipate what they're going to be about unless you understand that faith. And of course, we live in a society that talks a lot about separation of church and state, and we do want a certain level of separation of church and state. But that doesn't have anything to do with the separation of a man from his faith. And so I believe that Barack Obama, for example, is leading out of his brand of faith. George W. Bush was leading out of his brand of faith. And I think that's true of many of our presidents. And that's also why I wrote about Lincoln. He made a faith journey that shaped his leadership. So I think it's more than just of entertainment value and historical value. I think it actually is what we see at play in politics right to this moment.
And what it is the maybe the intersection of faith and maybe politics, is that somewhat unique, do you think, in maybe U.S. government compared to maybe other governing bodies around the world?
Well, my view is that it's unique only in that we acknowledge it. In other societies, you know, if they're officially Muslim society, they'll acknowledge it. In England, for example, they never speak of faith, rarely speak of faith shaping politics. They're quite shocked by it, but it obviously does. Whatever a man believes, if he's a secularist, socialist, if he's a, you know, evangelical or conservative Catholic, whatever, that is going to shape what he does in leadership. It's because of a broader principle, which is that people fundamentally live according to what they believe. Now, they can be inconsistent with it, they can betray it, but for the most part, day in, day out, they're living out whatever values they hold dear. And so that's going to be as true, you know, at the fruit market as it is going to be in politics, parliament, what have you. And what we need to do is understand it, both as voters and as people who might want to lead with them or in the opposite direction.
There were a number of, obviously, in the growth and development of our nation, there were a couple of presidents that sort of rise to the top and give us the reason for this day, certainly in terms of Lincoln and Washington. And both, faith was a key driver in all that they did, wasn't it?
It was. George Washington was, without question, a man of deep religious faith, talked a great deal about morals, talked a great deal about God, spoke in a great many churches. He was also a vestryman at Pohick Episcopal Church during a good chunk of his life until war took him away from those responsibilities. He gave his wife a Bible every year on her birthday. And Lincoln, of course, I've written a book about him, Lincoln's Battle with God. He started his life as a young man as an atheist, very influenced by Thomas Paine and a lot of the other rationalists and Enlightenment thinkers, but without question underwent a journey from that atheism, from being the village atheist, to a deep faith in God that shaped his presidency, and we can see this just pouring from the speeches that he made. So I don't think you really understand these men unless you understand their faith. It's not the only thing that's important about them, of course, but you really can't understand the rest of what they're doing and who they are without understanding what they believed.
You know, as I was reading the Manly Men book this weekend, you talked a little bit about, as you were reviewing some of the characteristics of a number of great men, some of them presidents, others in a variety of circumstances, that, you know, history, you know, gives us snapshots. And so, you know, we're in a world today where we only have sort of limited space time, I guess, to, you know, or you know, books can only spend so many pages on, you know, Lincoln or whoever it is. We don't necessarily always get the full story, do we, of what really influenced some of these great leaders?
There's no question about it. I mean, people are not reading as much history today as they might be, as they have in the past. They're interested. They're interested in sort of the History Channel versions, the documentary versions of these people's stories, famous people's stories. But they're not reading books themselves, and so it's hard, especially with someone as immense as Lincoln. I believe there are more books written about Abraham Lincoln every year than there are about any other figure except Jesus. I think that's still true, and so you can imagine the difficulty of staying current. I wrote a book on the book I've mentioned on Lincoln's faith, and it's gotten a huge amount of attention, mainly because it treated an aspect of Lincoln's life few people talk about, and it treated it with balance, and that just got it a lot of attention and sort of added to Lincoln lore. But people didn't know that story. The story had been was imbalanced when it was told. He was either an atheist or he was a deep, deep man of faith, you know, the Billy Graham of his time, and neither one of those is true. So I think that the more people are interested in these figures, the more we need to be making sure that the full body of their life comes to the fore. And I also think it's one of the most fascinating aspects of these people, how they reclaim themselves, how they go through hard times, how they suffer and rise again, largely on the strength of their faith. I think it's one of the most important elements in history.
Well, in fact, maybe just to give us a little bit of your backstory, did you start pursuing some of these history opportunities, biographies, because you were looking for illustrations of people who had overcome difficulties? I mean, you were pastoring at a time, right, or involved in the church?
You know, I have a bit of an unusual story I can detail in about 30 seconds. I was raised in Europe, the son of a military officer, really secular upbringing, became a Christian, went to a Christian college, majored in history, and became immediately fascinated with the values out of which leaders lead. I certainly understand the techniques and the different schools of thought about leaders and leadership, but But it seemed to me that ultimately the greatness of a leader came down to their ability to endure difficulty and be inspiring based on certain values they had, and those values usually came from religion. So I began to study in that arena, and by God's grace and just by the good graces of some publishers, about a decade later, I began to have the opportunity to write these books. And some of the early books reached people who eventually ended up in the White House. And so since they'd read my books, they said, yeah, you can write a book about faith in me. And that gave me access others hadn't had, and it allowed me to really explore that. I don't think you can understand George W. Bush's faith, his presidency, without understanding his faith. Like him or not, vote for him or not, think he's a fraud or not. The fact is he was executing a certain version of faith, so is Barack Obama. It may not be a faith that I agree with or you agree with, but it is a version of faith, and it is in a sense a fast track to understanding who they are. And a lot of the press, I think, swims around missing the point because they won't acknowledge openly the religious element in these people's lives. So anyway, that's become my role. And then, of course, I consult on those matters up on the Hill and try to help create a greater space for religious discussion and what have you. But I think this is one of the most neglected areas of history.
Well, we're taking a little time to reflect on history and leadership and the values out of where great leaders lead. We're going to talk more with Stephen Mansfield in just a moment. And get to some of his maxims from his book on manly men. That's his latest. But Stephen Mansfield's written a number of best-selling books, including The Faith of the American Soldier, The Faith of George W. Bush, The Faith of Barack Obama. He's written The Search for God in Guinness, Killing Jesus, others on Booker T. Washington, George Whitefield, Winston Churchill, and more. We'll talk with Stephen Mansfield in a moment. By the way, I do have a copy of Mansfield's book of Manly Men. We'd love to put you in a drawing for that. We'll give that away here at the end of the show today. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe you've read some of his works or have a thought or perspective, we'd welcome your conversation at 877-933-2484. 877-93-FAITH.
I like you.
No, I like you.
No, I really like you.
I liked you first.
As you can see at Faith Radio, we really like our friends on Facebook.
And we hope to connect with you there soon.
Find us when you search My Faith Radio on Facebook.
Or just browse to Facebook.com/MyFaithRadio.
It's connecting faith to your everyday life
right in your Facebook newsfeed.
We look forward to your like.
My Faith Radio on Facebook.
The church needs Christians who are equipped for battle. But this isn't a physical conflict. It's a war of the mind, a fight against heresy and hopelessness. Next time on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll maps out our field of combat. Be sure to tune in for the solid biblical counsel on the next Insight for Living.
Mornings at 8:30 here on Faith Radio.
That's not really your theme song, is it, Ryan?
No, sir.
You are a legend in your own mind, I know. But we are talking today. It's President's Day. And so we're spending some time just learning a bit about the leaders that we have experienced and enjoyed and benefited from in our country today, particularly as we think about Washington and Lincoln and getting some perspective on the great leaders of our time and some of the lessons that we can learn from them. Stephen Mansfield. Stephen's a best-selling author, popular speaker. He coaches leaders worldwide, and he also founded a couple of firms, the Mansfield Group and the Chartwell Literary Group, which provide executive coaching, media training, and literary services to clients around the world. He's a regular commentator on Fox and CNN and also a columnist for several prominent news and opinion websites, and we're honored to have him with us today. His latest book is called The Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, an utterly invigorating guide to being your most masculine self. We've got a copy to give away here at the end of the hour. You can call up and get on board for that at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Stephen, let's talk about maybe just some of the lessons. You mentioned the values of great leaders, and oftentimes it was enduring difficulty. I wonder if you just – let's talk maybe about some of the presidents. We can start with Lincoln if we want, or if we want to go to Truman or Roosevelt or others, but just maybe some of the characteristics, how the difficulties that they went through shaped their lives.
It's one of the principles that's not real fun to contemplate, especially if you want to be a leader one day. But almost every great leader is fashioned by great seasons of suffering, great seasons of difficulty. And it's the testing, it's the anvil, it's what shapes them ultimately. Lincoln suffered horribly in his life. He endured many, many deaths of loved ones. His mother died horribly in front of him. By saying she died horribly, I mean she had a disease that disfigured her and caused all kinds of upsetting syndromes. But she died with her hands on his head. He helped make the coffin with his father and bury her. Then his sister died when he was 16. The first love of his life, Ann Rutledge, died within months of him meeting her and falling in love. And he would lose two sons over his life, and then, of course, the hundreds of thousands killed in the Civil War. So he said all his days that the thought of rain falling on graves haunted him. He suffered horrible periods of suicide. His friends went on suicide watch, would take razors and so on out of his house. And people said he was the saddest man they'd ever seen, that he dripped melancholy as he walked. Now, he emerged from that to some degree as he embraced a deeper faith and knew the love of children and a wife, but he had the dark night of the soul many, many times, and it's very obvious that he could offer the nation hope in a dark time because he himself had been through near-death types of depression and had conquered it. The humor that he used, the stories, the inspiration that he used in his speeches, et cetera. And, we could just go on and on and on. I mean, people may not know that Theodore Roosevelt endured the death of his mother and his wife on the same day in the same house. It was a horrible time. In fact, he went and lived out in the Dakota Territories for quite some time just to recover himself because he was so traumatized. He was already in New York politics when it happened, but to lose his beloved wife and his dear mother on the same day in the same house, he spent hours running back and forth between the two floors of the house tending them, and they both died within hours. It was absolutely horrendous. I could go on and on and on. Some seem to be perpetually happy, like Truman, and not to have a trouble in the world. But they too endured criticism and dark sides of their souls and pain of various types. And so I just don't know of anyone who's truly great. We take Churchill, for example, whose father hated him and who suffered black dog depressions all of his life. In fact, Churchill, even when he was prime minister, didn't want to stay in a room with a balcony on it because he was afraid a depression might hit and he might throw himself off. So all of these people, some presidents, some not, show us what is often the case with leaders, and that is that they're fashioned in seasons of suffering. And really what pulls them out, what allows them to arise again, is what they believe at the core of their heart in those dark hours. And that usually is what they then offer in a slightly more public form to the world in times of crisis. Churchill's a prime example of that.
Where, because they could... they understood. It was almost, I guess, as we think about those words. Jesus is our high priest. He understands our weakness. I mean, these leaders truly did understand what I guess the common folk were going through many times. Right.
It's true. And there's another thing too, and that is that these leaders were able to offer the world something different, something new, something powerful, because they had gone through dark times, and many of them battled depression. And when you're going through a really difficult time, it sort of removes you from people. It causes you to look at the world and society as though through a glass, as though you're somewhat removed from it. Well, that gives you perspective for leading. That gives you insight, wisdom, understanding. I don't want to create a theology where we think we have to run into suffering and pursue it in order to accomplish anything of weight. But I never have forgotten the words of my friend Peggy Noonan. She was watching George W. Bush and Al Gore debate, and she said later, "You wish that they both had suffered more." And we teased her for being so cruel, wishing that they had suffered. What she was saying, though, was you wish there was greater gravitas in their souls. Now, this is early before Bush's presidency. You wish that there was a greater weightiness about them. And what she knew was that often came through suffering. So it really does have a role. And, yes, for those who cling to God, that's what happens in those dark hours. They confront their total reliance on God, and that sustains them in those later public days of leadership.
Yes, we hear certainly President Bush talked about that back in his time, that there was, as the as the difficulties increased, I mean, he was in the Lincoln, I guess, the same thing. He's He was forced to his knees many times because there was no one else, no place else to go. I mean, that in that position of leadership, particularly the presidency, that you get the gray hair and the character all coming together.
Well, you know, I certainly have never been president, don't aspire to be, but I have known a number of them, and I've written about several of them. And, of course, I've read about all of them at some point in time or another, and makes me no expert, but I will tell you one common theme is the unbelievable loneliness, pressure, and worry that comes with the presidency. You are, at least in maybe the last century or so, the most powerful man in the world. Your decisions affect lives, sometimes instantly, in Lincoln's case, hundreds of thousands. And you just, a human being cannot bear that alone. I cannot imagine a president who does not have some faith basis. I mean, I'm trying to be broad here, but for me, it would need to be a radical faith in God and his son, Jesus Christ, and a total reliance on the Holy Spirit's help. But I don't know how a man endures that kind of pressure, especially in the wrangling politics that we have today. So the greatest presidents then have been people of deep faith, because you have to have that to survive.
Can you, I mean, you're a leadership coach. How do you coach someone, without saying, you know, embrace difficulty, run to difficulty, but how do you coach them to know that difficulties will come and that there will be some testing that will that can either sort of turn them, bring them stronger or break them apart?
Well, I try to help those that I coach understand, first of all, that they have to not be cowards in the face of the challenges of their life at the time, even before they get into leadership. I mean, a difficulty can be a son who's not, you know, who doesn't obey or is not maybe your biggest fan for a season. You know, my son didn't think I was all that awesome during his teen years, and now we're real close. You know, it can be confronting your own demons. It can be not just allowing yourself to be an angry man. Go ahead and confront what makes you angry, what first tainted your soul. So the first level is just to deal courageously with the troubles that you have in your life. But then I always try to help them understand that leadership is, in essence, confronting difficulties. I mean, some presidents have left office and said, I didn't have a good day my entire time in the White House. Well, that's sort of an immature way of saying I was challenged every single day. There wasn't a day, you know, with a glass of wine or whatever, you know, or there wasn't a day by the pool all the whole time. No, that's not what you're there for. You might get some rest. You might get to fly to Hawaii or fly to Crawford, Texas and take a break. But you are in the driver's seat of one of the most important institutions in the world. You're powerful, and every day is going to seem like a fight. That's what you're there for. That's what you do. You're not unlike a general, you know, during some of our great wars. And so I just say to them, look, prepare yourself. Every day will bring a fight. Every day will bring a battle. It will bring hardship. But each of those hardships is an opportunity to change what the institution that you're leading and make history. It all depends on how you react to it. And a cowardly approach says, you know, I want a rose garden. I want something. I want a quiet place to sit and be left alone and have the world go by. Well, then don't run for public office. But if you're going to run for public office, you better, you know, in the image of my favorite movie, Braveheart, you better strap on your kilt, paint your face blue, and get ready to charge the enemies of your age, you know, because it's not a peaceful calling.
Well, and yet I would think as we, you know, get into a bit about your book, A Manly Man, that there is something within a man that wants to rise to that challenge anyway, right?
Exactly. Some men want to escape responsibility and duty. Other men run to it. And the greatest of American presidents were not people who happened into it accidentally or you know, just by political party machinery, but they aspire to. I think great men want to have the responsibility. It's like the player on the basketball court who wants the ball. He's not hiding from it. He's not passing it off. Give me the ball. I'll make the play. And it can be some ego. It can be some bravado. But I think when men have been through what many of our great presidents had been before they ever got to the Oval Office, they know who they are. They've looked around, they've seen other men, and they know they have something to offer, and they want to offer it to the nation. And I think if that's really pure and God-ordained, then it's what makes great heroes.
Well, coming up after a break, we'll get to a couple of questions. One of them, why would a good man want to be president 2014? We'll get to that. We're going to talk to more with Steve Mansfield about some of his maxims. The Book of Manly Men is the latest book. We're also talking about presidents. He's written several, of course, bestsellers, The Faith of President, Faith of George Bush, The Faith of George W. Bush, The Faith of Barack Obama, and more. We've got a copy of the Manly Men book to give away. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. And we'll talk more with Stephen Mansfield in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. We were made to be courageous and we're taking back the fight. We were made to be courageous and it starts with us tonight. The only way we'll ever stand is on our knees with lifted hands. Make us courageous. We're talking about character qualities of great leaders and getting some perspective on the presidents and other men that have had significant influence on our world. Talking about Mansfield's book of Manly Men, that's the latest from Stephen Mansfield. Stephen is a best-selling author and a speaker and coaches. He's founded a couple of firms, the Mansfield Group and the Chartwell Literary Group, and he's a regular commentator on Fox and CNN, also a columnist, and has written a number of books, including, as we've been talking about, The Faith of George W. Bush, The Faith of Barack Obama, celebrated biographies of Booker T. Washington, George Whitefield, Winston Churchill, Pope Benedict the 16th, yes, and others. So anyway, Stephen's with us today. We've got a copy of the Manly Men book to give away at 877-93-FAITH, and we'll get to Dan's call in a moment. But Stephen, I want to ask you, we mentioned a few minutes ago, we were talking about, you know, don't be a coward, be courageous. Are there some other character qualities that great leaders need to have?
Well, the greatest ones have compassion. They don't just go in like a bull in a china shop, contending for one side and unable to think about the hurting, the needy, or even the wisdom that their enemies might have. There's almost always an element of compassion and balance that's very important. They almost always have a moral code. They don't see situations and events and some kind of a swimming sort of murky decision-making process. They apply a moral code to it, and they see what's right and wrong. Churchill during World War II, didn't wonder about Nazism. He said it was the blackest paganism, and the Christian nations ought to rise against it. You know, he drew very clear lines, and so people knew how to act. Excuse me, when leaders don't sound clear trumpets, then the followers don't know what to do. And the great leaders sound a very clear moral trumpet, and that's what rallies the nation, the peoples, to great deeds. So those are very important. And then really one of the things that I'm most impressed with about some of the great leaders in our history is that you must not just have a message, you must embody your message. Ronald Reagan, without question, with his life, with his actions, with his style, with his words, he embodied his message. Agree with it or not, he at least embodied his message. Other leaders did the same thing. They lived out their values. If you watched them, you saw what they believed in action, in shoes, as some people say. And that's important because you can't just persuade people of an idea that doesn't grace your own life. You have to embody and represent that idea and put it in the flesh, so to speak, incarnate it. And that's why we gravitate to the heroism of Washington or the boldness of Churchill I think Truman, very, very courageous man, immensely courageous man, particularly given, you know, his look, kind of the Poindexter look. But he constantly showed unbelievable steely courage that came from, I imagine, his Missouri rural background. But very impressive in how these men embraced and embodied what they believed.
I was just thinking, too, you're talking about Truman, about how all that he sort of went through during his tenure, but you could probably say that about all the presidents, that they were all sort of monumental moments that, the world changes rapidly in wars and, developments of all kinds, and these men are at the helm in some strategic times.
Well, Truman is one of my favorites, and of course the great book by David McCullough is one everybody should read, but we do forget how much his presidency included. I mean, massive strikes, the Korean War, I could just go on and on and on with the things he had to endure. Plus, he inherited the presidency from a man who never would have chosen Truman, probably, if he thought that Truman would actually end up being president. And the nation was stunned, and for Truman to have to take the helm after after President Roosevelt died. It was one of the most horrific things he ever had to endure. So all of this to say that the Truman, more than most, was like the common man who had to rise to meet exceptional challenges, and I think did so beautifully. The sign on his desk, I think, speaks of his fundamental values. The buck stops here. I'm going to handle it. I'm going to roar into it. I'm going to be the man who makes the decisions. And he made some decisions people don't agree with him about to this day, like firing MacArthur and so on. But the bottom line is that this is what heroism looks like. It's a man who believes in certain things and is willing to sacrifice himself in the causes he believes in with overwhelming courage. And I think he's an exemplar of that.
You'll find more about Truman's life and many others in the book, The Book of Manly Men from Stephen Mansfield, and got a copy of that to give away here at the end of the show. Let's go to Dan, who's waiting in on line one. Dan has a question for Stephen. Go ahead.
I appreciate you taking my call. Relative to leadership, I try to get my mind around the formula of where God picks up and man leaves off. You know, and is there some description you can provide in terms of you having that courage that you're talking about that Truman has, but you know, when do you surrender to God in certain situations and not to, and in obedience do certain things? So it's this formula of working with God to play out courage, and wondering if you can describe that a little bit from what you've learned.
Okay, thanks.
Well, I think you always want to surrender to God in every aspect of your individual life. But when you turn to lead publicly, of course you want to be led by God, but you shouldn't still be working out those issues of character and courage that needed to be fashioned in private. This is one of the great themes of the lives of great men and women. They've done the business they needed to do in private. They've had the dark night of the soul. They fought through their depressions. They've battled through the deaths of loved ones. They've confronted themselves, so to speak. And so they're fashioned. They are they've solidified in a sense, and they know who they are. It doesn't mean they don't follow the leading of God in their public lives, but it does mean that they're no longer questioning themselves, doubting themselves. They're no longer uncertain. They know their values, they know who they are, and they know what they're called to do. And so it creates not a bravado, but a confidence and a certainty. So I think, frankly, for many of them who were Christians, it was surrendering to God in every area of their life that they possibly could muster that then fashioned them into the leaders they were made to be. And it's also why many of them could offer the hope of their own faith in times of crisis, because they had been lifted out of their dark valleys during their lives by that faith. And I think that's the bottom line. You submit in every way, but then as you submit, you're made into something. You're fashioned into something. God's forming you into something. And in time, you have confidence of that, and you continue to submit to God, but you also can walk in a confidence and a strength that comes from your history with God.
All right. Let's go to Brian on line two. Brian has a question about maybe understanding the heart of the leader. Brian, go ahead. You're on with Stephen Mansfield.
Yes, I guess I was even thinking more about when, like during a campaign time. Sometimes as voters, it's hard to know, you know, what a person is really like, what a candidate is really like. You hear sound bites and ideas, but I was just wondering if the author had any suggestions of, you know, how do you get a picture of somebody who's running for an office, what they may really be like if you don't know them.
Yeah. Okay. There's a tremendous repainting job, refinishing job that happens on a candidate once they declare themselves for office, and that suddenly they're these heroic figures and, you know, bright colors and paintbrush pictures and so on. The way to understand a candidate is to dig behind the immediate campaign rhetoric to their earlier lives. Take a little time, read some of the articles that do flyovers of their earlier life. If there are books written on their lives up to that point, read them. You want to understand John McCain, understand what he endured as a POW, understand what his life has been prior to being in office. Again, once a person declares, once a party begins to sort of polish somebody up for the campaigns, there's a lot of distortion, there's a lot of overspeak, that can be confusing. But what has this person been? What has their faith life been? What have they endured? Did they fail and then rise? Did they just continue to fail and make excuses? Look over their life the way you would look over your own life or the life of a friend or the life of somebody that you were thinking about going into business with. and try to just look around the hype a bit. I'm all for campaign expressions and slogans and what have you, but the man or the woman is really revealed in their history more than they're revealed in the immediate, you know, kind of thrust and parry of the campaign. So that's my best advice.
Well, it sort of ties in with another listener question. So why would someone want to be the president, knowing that your character and reputation is going to be attacked, perhaps destroyed?
Well, it's one of the big sacrifices that has to be made. Some people run for office out of sheer ego. Some people run for office because they've got a radical agenda of some sort. They want to change everything that's come before. The ones that I admire, though, simply know that they're called to it. It's one of the biggest things they wrestle with. They aren't just people of ego. They aren't just people of ambition or vanity. Everybody has some of that in their life, but they've wrestled for hours, many of them, about what exactly it will cost. I think you see this, by the way, not that I'm saying the man should have been president by it all, but Netflix has done this little documentary on called Mitt, and it's about Mitt Romney. And it's just a camera following him through his two presidential campaigns. Well, it's very revealing of how much he wrestled with what it would cost his family. His wife didn't even want him to. After he lost the first time, she said, "Never again, big boy." But she did, of course, stay with him the second time and help him in his second campaign. But the price to the family, the suffering, the pain, this is what they wrestle with. And the best of them, the best of the candidates, are people who have understand that, recognize that, the loss of privacy, the criticism of every member of their family down to the last detail, but they see it as the price of a chance to shape history.
So do we have realistic expectations today for men or women who seek to lead us, maybe not even just as the nation, but even in companies? I mean, are we expecting more than what they can really deliver?
Almost always we are, yes. We have about leadership a messianic complex. And it really does get in the way. If you like Barack Obama, fine. That's your choice. But he's not the Messiah. He's not going to bring a new era of peace and prosperity. There's not going to be a new order of the ages. You know, the next president who gets elected, you know, Republican, let's say, he or she is amazing, exemplary, absolutely above the crowd, or else they wouldn't be running for president. But no president brings a whole new era. No president changes everything. And again, the president's not Jesus. A CEO is not Jesus. We're not talking about the dawn of the millennium here. And I think that we have very overbloated expectations. Of course, PR and the PR of campaigns feeds this. We expect way too much. What we want are good, honest men and women who make the best decisions they can make and know how to lead people and inspire them to accomplish great things. Churchill's come along once in millennia. You're going to have good people, but you're not going to have great people. And even some of the ones that I would consider great, I have many academic historian friends who would say, no, they weren't great. They were terrible. You know, I have professor friends who despise Ronald Reagan, think he almost destroyed the country. Well, I don't. So you're always going to have to be looking at these issues in the life of a candidate. But I think this is really, really important. It's something very central to how we ought to be thinking about politics. We want things to improve. We want things to rise. We want to put good people in office. But we're not electing God here. We are simply electing people who hopefully can help us out of our problems and move the ball further down the field in our national history.
We're going to come back in a moment and pick up a question from Alex about, what does it mean to be a Christian man? And then we'll get to Stephen Mansfield's maxims as well, kind of review those. We'll talk more with Stephen. His latest book is called The Book of Manly Men. It's a recommended reading for you and your sons, your brothers, your dad, uncles. It'll be, and, you know, wives will want to read it as well. Stephen Mansfield, best-selling author, popular speaker, coaches leaders worldwide. Grew up in Europe as a army, son of an army officer, and has had a number of different roles and responsibilities. Earned a doctorate, a couple degrees. He's written on Winston Churchill, Booker T. Washington, George Whitefield, many others, the faith of George Bush, the faith of Barack Obama, the faith of the American soldier, and others. And we're going to talk a little bit more with Stephen Mansfield in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Are you struggling to keep up with your fitness plans for the new year? We want to help. Join us for Commit to Live Fit 40-Day Challenge as Susie Larson leads you down a six-week journey of faith and fitness. During these next few weeks, we'll focus on physical and spiritual steps to a healthier life as you commit to live fit. Sign up for free at myfaithradio.com. We start March 3rd. It's not too late to sign up for Commit to Live Fit 40-Day Challenge.
Life's journey is unpredictable. One day you're in the valley, and the next day you're on top of the mountain. Set Apart 2014. Ah, the journey invites you to share life and faith stories with Dee Breston, Angie Smith, Susie Larson, and Wendy Pett at this year's conference, March 7th and 8th at University of Northwestern, St. Paul. For more information about Set Apart speakers, workshops, and to register, call 651-631-5151 or simply setapartconference.com.
It's President's Day, taking some time to talk a little bit about the great men in our nation that have led us and their character qualities. And thankfully, we've had someone who's researched many of these great men of faith and leadership. Stephen Mansfield has written a number of books, one of his best known, The Faith of George W. Bush, came out back in, 04 or before that, and The Faith of Barack Obama as well. Both were probably influential, I think, in the election outcomes. He's also written The Faith of the American Soldier. In fact, spent a year or so with the troops in, maybe it wasn't a year, but he was with the troops in Iraq in 2005. We can touch on that here in a bit. Stephen, I did want to get to, Alex had a question. He says, how does being a man in Christianity differ from being defined as a man in other religions?
Well, in Christianity, you believe that God has defined, first of all, what manhood is. He has defined your responsibilities, and he gives you the grace, the power, the wisdom, and the insight to do it. Now, other religions, many of them don't have any definition of gender roles. They aren't as personal. Islam, for example, is not a religion that deals with the heart. It doesn't deal with the internals. It's not a religion that would define gender roles, for example, in any kind of, you know, manner that people actually live out. It just sort of establishes the requirements of God for all, you know, for all men in every case. Whereas, and then of course the other aspect of the biblical definition or the Christian view of manhood is that we believe that God gifts people differently. We Christians believe that some are given one package of gifts, you know, mercy or generosity or other, you know, all the different configurations that can be put together. And so people are unique, and God defines their lives, God defines their roles and gifts them differently. So a lot of what a Christian man is called to do is to walk out that destiny, knowing who he is, knowing how he's been made, and putting that in the service of others. So having studied world religions, it's interesting how few religions actually take any time at all to define these issues. It's much clearer in Scripture. And I think that actually heightens the responsibility on a Christian man.
Well, it's a nice segue into talking about Mansfield's maxims. Let's review those four key truths, because they really are important.
Well, I'm a big believer in these four principles, and they're a little bit different from the traditional man teaching, so to speak, that we see in the church. First of all, the first principle is, and we humorously call these Mansfield's manly maxims, but the first one is manly men do manly things. I say it this way to make a little bit of a break from the earlier men's movement, which was wonderful, but focused a lot on the inner life and the emotions and the healing of the masculine soul. When I'm on the campuses and I'm talking to young men, they say, look, I know we're all messed up, but just tell me what to do. So in this book, I spend time telling men, you know, exactly what does manhood look like? What are the responsibilities, the duties? Second of all, the second manly maxim is manly men tend their field. I believe, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians, that there's a field assigned to each of us, that there's a body of responsibilities, the words in Greek are metron, really, metron of grace. We get the word meter from it. It's an actual kind of a measured space that we are responsible for. It's, you know, if in most men's cases, it's a family and a job and a house and whatever other property, whatever other responsibilities he's given. That's his field. He's got to tend it well. He doesn't surrender that to his wife and say, hey, you take care of the kids. He doesn't surrender financial responsibility. He's the one who's tending his field, from the souls of his children to the care for the house, to the direction of the family, to the financial well-being. That's his field, and manly men tend their field. The third one is manly men make manly men. I'm all for books, seminars, movies, but the bottom line is in every church and every company and all throughout our culture, we need a culture of men who are encouraging each other to be righteous and godly men and are also defending and protecting and welcoming the young. There's an African proverb that says if we don't initiate the boys, they will burn the village down. And we're seeing that in our society. We're raising up young barbarians, and what we need are righteous men who are taking boys into their lives and mentoring them and teaching them and initiating them and helping them to become great men. And there's so many things we could talk about how boys are under, and boyhood itself is under attack these days. And then finally, manly men live to the glory of God. I teach men all over the country and the world, really, that you really can't do what you're called to do as a man if you don't live for the applause of heaven, if you don't have the resources of God, the wisdom, the insight, the patience, and if you are simply living for some kind of fulfillment here on earth. A man's called to do such exceptional things that he really does need to have his gaze turned to the Lord and also rely on the resources of the Lord to fulfill that manly mandate, so to speak. So those are the four maxims that we build on in the book.
And the book goes on to talk about important characteristics. Think about honor and integrity and quest and wildness and many other things of which we don't have time to get into, I guess. I did want to even ask maybe a little bit about, we've been talking about leadership today and, the presidents, but there are leaders who have been derailed. And I wonder if we just say a word or two about some of the things that can easily derail us, no matter what our position of leadership would be.
You know, I really do care about this area, and as a consultant and a leadership coach, do a lot of work in this area. I've written a little booklet called 10 Signs of a Leadership Crash, a little ebook for about $2 or $3, available on Amazon. But I'm not just trying to sell books, but I know I can't say enough now for those who might be in this kind of crisis. But the fact is that there are specific signs of the leadership crashes we often see around us, from pastors who fall to politicians who, you know, have affairs or misuse their privileges financially and end up in jail. I mean, the mayor of New Orleans is going to jail here, the guy who seemed so heroic back during Katrina. And so I'm grieved by all of that. And as a guy who's been called in time and time again to help clean up those messes and to restore the people, restore the companies, restore even sometimes the branches of government, I can tell you that there are signposts of those things. You can see them coming down the road. When you see a man isolate him, when you see him give himself to bitterness, things of that nature, you really can see the signposts, as I call them. And I'll tell you, it really is a plague. I know a consultant who's doing a study now to try to figure out how much damage has been done to American business through personal moral failures of business leaders. And it's in the billions. It's huge. It's one of the biggest companies have. When they have a major leader crash and the brand suffers PR hit and the internal administration suffers every kind of disillusionment, and it's horrible. Personal suffering is terrible, and that's something we've got to begin to watch. The companies have got to stop just thinking they can put a person into a role of incredible responsibility and visibility, and then not be concerned about the matters of soul and family health that might lead to horrible crashes. So. This great leaders in history have avoided those for the most part. Unwise ones have entangled themselves in lesser immoralities that just siphoned off their strength and their greatness. But it's something we're all going to have to learn, because we're living in a society just rife with temptation, and we got to make sure that our souls are solid so we can survive, thrive, and lead.
In the book, Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, there are short chapters and a number of little quotes from the likes of Edgar Guest, who doesn't get nearly as much publicity as he should, and Rudyard Kipling and others, and you'll find it encouraging. You mentioned one of your favorite movies, Braveheart, and I thought, we've got about 3 minutes left. Maybe what's a lesson that we can learn from that, maybe just in terms of God's call to us to to see what he has for us in the days ahead, to be manly men?
Well, I mean, Braveheart is such a great movie, and there's so many illustrations I could draw on it. I wrote the book, Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, because I wanted to say to men, look, you may be flawed, you may be damaged, you may come from a situation where you were unfathered, or you know, you're feeling the insecurity of a bad background, but greatness is not a matter of being flawless. It's not a matter of being pristine and perfect. It's a matter of caring enough about what you love and what you believe in that you are willing to throw yourself into the fight. And in typical Mel Gibson production style, Braveheart shows a man who is sacrificing just about everything for what he believes. He's committed to his tribe. He's committed to his God. He's committed to the battles of the moment, the fighting on the right side of the battles of the moment. And he becomes a man who inspires others. Time and again in that film, what does he do? He gives a speech. He goes out there and picks a fight. He embodies almost physically the what he's calling other men to. And that's really greatness. That greatness is when you simply believe and are willing to commit yourself in such a way that you rally others to the cause. And anybody can do that, no matter how weak or damaged their background. And that's what I want to sound a trumpet call for men to step up and do what they're called to do, be what they're called to be in this generation. There's hardly been a better time or a more desperate time for men to be what they're made to be. And, of course, it's at a time when many authors are saying men are useless these days. But I think just the opposite is true.
Stephen, I know you've spent many years in church leadership as well. Is there maybe a verse or two that kind of comes to mind that you look at, sort of keep coming back to when you think about, you know, God's perspective on being a manly man?
You know, there are two places in the Bible, they may not be the only ones, but there are two very very stark places where the word man is not used to indicate a male, but it's used to indicate the characteristics of a man. The one we know very well is when David was dying and he turned to his son and said, show yourself a man. Show yourself. Live out the characteristics of manhood. And the other one is one of my favorites. It's when God shows up at the end of the book of Job after Job has suffered and his friends have sat around talking nonsense for about 27 chapters. And God shows up with an attitude, and he turns to Job and says, brace yourself like a man and prepare to make a defense. And again, both of these references are where it's obvious there are certain characteristics that identify a man, and in both those situations, other men are being called to them. So, you know, they may not be detailed in every specific in the Bible, but it's obvious that God is hinting to us, and more than just hinting, that there is a life to lead for a man that is exceptional, that is different, that is bold, and that is courageous. And that's how I want to live and summon other men to the same thing.
Done well encouraging us today. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us. The book is called, The Book of Manly Men. It's an utterly invigorating guide to being your most masculine self. You'll find it's witty, it's compelling. You'll find more on all that we've talked about today. And you can look at all of Stephen's writings as well. Online. It's themansfieldgroup.com. You can find out about his speaking opportunities there. Stephen, thank you for your research and your writing and encouraging us today.
Man, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Connecting Faith. If you missed a part of today's broadcast, you can check it out on the podcast at myfaithradio.com. It's myfaithradio.com.